seated in the audience, April Gassler, and I'd like to introduce her to the court. And I thank you for your time.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mary Mateer from Morris James, and I'm here today on behalf of National Union, one of the two appellees today. And I'm here with Jeffrey Weil from the Deckert Law Firm, who will be arguing second for the appellees, and we are dividing the time equally among the two.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
And good morning, Justices. Jason Sincilla of Morris Nichols for the appellant, AT&T Wireless Services, Inc. I have with me today, and I'm happy to introduce Bill Cronin of the Court Cronin Law Firm in Seattle, Washington. Also, Diane Bonina from AT&T and the better part of the summer class from Morris Nichols.
Good morning. Welcome to you all. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is William Cronin, and I am appearing as counsel on behalf of AT&T Wireless, who is the appellant. It is an honor and a privilege to appear before this court today. I will use my 15 minutes for my opening and reserve 5 minutes for my reply. I will not cover all the issues that have been briefed. There's just too much to address. I do hope to answer any questions the court may have, however. I plan to cover the following points: why this appeal is governed by two decisions from this court in 2007 arising out of the coverage action by AT&T, the parent entity, related to the demise of a company called At Home, Inc., and the two decisions issued by this court, which I think are controlling precedent, are a decision issued in February of 2007 that I will call the Faraday decision, and a decision issued in July of 2007 that I will call the Clarendon decision. And both decisions relate to the same coverage litigation instituted by AT&T. Second point I'd like to cover is why respondent insurers' attempts to distinguish away these controlling precedents must fail. And third, I'd like to argue why Washington law should be applied to the extra contractual claims of AT&T Wireless against the respondent insurers. In all these arguments, it will remain important to keep one thing at center stage, which is the procedural posture of this appeal. This is a review of a motion to dismiss decision in which a trial court granted the motion to dismiss. The review is de novo. All facts pled in AT&T Wireless amended complaint must be treated as true, and all inferences, reasonable inferences from those facts, must be taken in AT&T's favor. And I recite this simply because there have been instances during the course of the briefing in which respondents have either asked you to ignore the allegations that have been pled or have asked you to actually conclude that those allegations are wrong, meaning they have disputed those allegations for the purposes of their argument. Let me turn to the two controlling precedents. First controlling precedent.
Mr. Cronin.
Yes.
It's clear from the briefing that there are separate groups of issues that are being presented depending on whether we're talking about your claim, that is your client's claim against its own insurer, or its claim against the other side's insurer. And it would help if you can give us a reference point, that is, when you're making your arguments, you know, which claim are we talking about?
I will do that, Your Honor. The first controlling precedent that I'm going to talk about is the court's decision in February 2007, captioned AT&T Corp. versus Faraday Capital, and that's at 918 A. 2nd, 1104. And this decision is relevant to AT&T Wireless's claims under its insurance coverage. That decision considered the Faraday decision by this court, considered the scope of an exclusion in insurance policies, and the scope of the exclusion turned on the meaning of the word claim. The parallels between the issues in that appeal and the issues in this appeal are many, and I just need to recite them. First, both this appeal and Faraday concerned the insurance company's attempts to define an exclusion in a broad way through the use of the word claim in its definition. Second, both this appeal and the Faraday appeal involved essentially the same policy definitions for the word claims. Third, both this appeal and the Faraday appeal involve an argument by insurance companies that the word claim for exclusion purposes should be interpreted so as to exclude coverage for the entire lawsuit if there is in the lawsuit any single claim or cause of action that is excluded from coverage. This court rejected that argument in Faraday and found that the trial court had committed error in excluding coverage for all claims in a lawsuit simply because one claim or cause of action might be excluded. The same mistake was made here by the trial court below. In granting dismissal below of AWS's claims for coverage under its policies, the trial court granted the motion to dismiss because it found that there were some claims in the underlying amended shareholder complaint that implicated the actions of AWS officers who had been nominated to and were serving on the Telecorp board. The problem with the decision...
Well, your point is that the complaint alleges two types of claims, some of which may be excluded under your insurer's policy because they arise out of service by AT&T's designees on the other company's board. But there are other claims that are against AT&T Wireless as a corporation, irrespective or not related to activities by its designees on the board of the acquired company.
That's exactly my point.
And that turns basically on how we parse out the complaint. That is, the other side says, no, even under your view of Faraday, all the claims in the complaint, are factually related to or arise out of conduct of AT&T's director designees on the board of the acquired company. How are we to resolve that?
Well, if you can resolve it by looking at the complaint in the amended complaint filed in the shareholder action, and you will see two things. First, you'll see there are two claims in the amended shareholder action that are alleged against AT&T as an entity. The first is an alleged breach of AT&T's duties as a shareholder to other Telecorp shareholders. That claim on its face does not relate to any action taken by AWS nominees while sitting on the Telecorp board. It relates to the actions undertaken by AT&T as an entity in negotiating, timing, and proceeding with the merger offer. Second, there's a complaint alleged against AT&T for aiding and abetting Telecorp directors in breaching their fiduciary duties. The complaint doesn't tell you specifically which directors the aiding and abetting claim relates to, but the complaint contains a set of allegations that clearly do not implicate any actions by AWS nominees on the Telecorp board. And here's the set of allegations. The complaint in the underlying shareholder action alleges that AWS, the entity, entered into a side deal with two Telecorp directors, a Mr. Vento and Mr. Sullivan. The side deal is alleged to have been entered into in December of 2000, some 8 to 9 months before AT&T made its proposal for merger. The allegation is that in the side deal, AT&T bought licenses that Mr. Vento and Mr. Sullivan owned, paid Mr. Vento and Mr. Sullivan in excess of $140 million. And the allegation is, as part of that transaction, AT&T essentially bought Mr. Vento's and Mr. Sullivan's approval of the merger that AT&T would ultimately propose for Telecorp.
Could you give us the allegation that you say sets that forth?
I can, Your Honor. I believe it's cited in the brief. I can't give you the appendix page and the paragraph number. I will do so in reply. But more important than what I've just described is the allegation in the underlying complaint is that this side deal was never disclosed to the Telecorp board. So on its face, there's a set of allegations involving conduct by AT&T and conduct by Mr. Vento and Mr. Sullivan that does not in any way implicate any action taken by the AWS nominees on the Telecorp board.
That leads to another question, and I'm a little confused about it. There's an underlying policy, but that's not an issue in this case, is it?
There's a primary policy issued in favor of Telecorp.
We're talking at this point about the primary policy issued in favor of AT&T Wireless, aren't we?
In connection with this argument, we are, Your Honor.
Okay, and what is the status of that, of the coverage under that? Is that contested as well?
That's contested. Basically, AT&T Wireless had two policies that we believe provided coverage for the claims against AT&T.
Federal is the underlying policy?
Federal was the underlying policy on the Telecorp line of insurance. There are two towers of insurance. Telecorp had procured a tower of insurance. In that tower, the insurers were Federal for the first $10 million, National Union for the next $10 million, and St. Paul for the $10 million above that. There's a separate line of coverage that AT&T purchased for itself. That line of coverage provides $25 million worth of coverage in the primary layer. That's provided by the London market. Faraday was the leading syndicate in that coverage. And National Union is the carrier that sits on top of that, and National Union provides $25 million coverage over that.
Okay, we haven't heard anything from Faraday.
Well, what happened is Faraday has been dismissed from the case. AT&T filed the Rule 41 motion because AT&T, its preference was to proceed against Faraday and National Union on the AT&T line of coverage in federal court in Washington. We had an automatic right under Rule 41 to proceed.
And you did, and there was a judgment entered against Faraday, and there was a settlement or what?
No, there's been no judgment entered against Faraday. There have been no legal issues resolved. There's been no legal proceedings that have moved forward in connection with the AT&T line of coverage. And the reason is the federal action has been stayed.
So basically we're being asked to adjudicate the liability of a secondary layer of coverage, that is the excess carrier, without having any information at this point, at least adjudicated information, about the liability of the primary carrier.
Well, the primary carrier may be back in this case. That remains to be seen based on what this court does. But what this court is being asked to do is basically to decide that under the terms of the policy that National Union and National Union is a policy, National Union follows the form of the Faraday policy. National Union is saying that under the terms of this policy, there is no coverage whatsoever for the claims alleged against AT&T. And they make that argument based on the exclusion that appears in the Faraday policy and is incorporated by reference into the National Union policy.
Right, and your point is that there are claims made against AT&T as an entity that don't fall within the exclusion, and if there's any question about it, those questions have to be resolved in your client's favor.
Absolutely.
Now, if we were to hold that, what impact would that have, if any, on the litigation in Washington?
Well, I think the court is asking me what would AT&T do? It would face two choices, it seems to me. If this case returns to the trial court and Judge Carpenter, with the court having decided that we can proceed against the ATT line of coverage, we would ask Judge Carpenter at that time to consider whether he should go forward and decide those questions that arise under that line of coverage, because we think that all those questions will be determined by Washington law, or whether he should defer to the federal court and allow the federal court to resolve and address those.
So there'll be a forum issue.
There'll be a forum issue, and we will end up proceeding either in Delaware or in Washington in the federal court proceeding, depending upon what Judge Carpenter decides. So let me turn to the second precedent that we believe is controlling in this case, and that's the Clarendon decision. And the Clarendon decision was issued in July of 2000. In that decision, this court reversed a trial court dismissal of coverage claim by AT&T. Again, the parallels between the trial court decision in that case and the trial court decision that's on appeal in this case are very striking. Both cases involve a claim by an insurance company that no loss occurred sufficient to trigger coverage. Both cases involve essentially the same definition of loss in the policies. Both cases involve the insurance companies arguing and the trial courts agreeing that there is no loss unless the directors have in a document acknowledged a legal obligation to pay a loss or been adjudicated as liable to pay a loss. And both cases involve a settlement payment by an AT&T entity on behalf of the directors for which coverage is sought.
Excuse me, you are into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use.
I think at this point I will stand on the briefs and save my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Thomas Judge on behalf of St. Paul Mercury Insurance Company. St. Paul, as Mr. Cronin explained, is the highest level access carrier on the Telecor Power Insurance. And I'd like to just jump right in, picking up where Mr. Cronin left off on this no loss issue. AWS relies on the Clarendon decision of this court from July 2007 to overturn the Superior Court's decision. And he says, first off, that the policies in Clarendon are similar in their definition of loss as the policies issued to Telecor, and that's just wrong. And we point that out in our briefs. Importantly, in Clarendon, this court stated that if the insurers wanted to accept from the definition of loss amounts paid by any other party other than the insured organization, the company, as it was referred to in Clarendon, then that would have made the insurer's intent clear that they did not intend to cover amounts paid by a third-party entity such as AT&T in that case. Here, the federal policy, the primary policy issued to Telecor, has that very express exception in the definition of loss.
If I understand your position correctly, there are really two arguments that your side is raising as an obstacle to the Clarendon, to the other side's Clarendon argument. That was one of them. That is the carve-out. And the second is that in order for AT&T to have any standing, I guess, to assert this claim, it would have to do that in its capacity as the successor to Telecorp. Do I have that right?
Do you, Your Honor, but they seem closely connected, and there's actually a separate issue beyond that. And the way those two issues that you just described are closely connected is we say federal policy has this express carve-out that any amounts paid other than as indemnity by Telecorp are not covered.
Well, why doesn't the amended complaint support an inference that AWS was an insured organization?
Throughout, as AWS has pointed out in their reply brief, throughout their amended complaint, they allege that they are a successor in interest to Telecorp. That
in other words, they are Telecorp for purposes of this claim.
Right. And that is a legal conclusion. What they haven't alleged, and what they need to allege in good faith, and those would be allegations that we can test in discovery, what they haven't alleged, as we believe they cannot allege, is they have cited cases saying that hold that when there is a statutory merger, the surviving entity succeeds to the rights of the merged company. But what they haven't alleged, and what they apparently cannot allege,
is that they that AWS merged with Pellicor, and that AWS was the surviving entity. So they're citing legal principle about successor and interest status, and they're just claiming it in their complaint. What they haven't alleged is factually that they that AWS merged with Telecor and that AWS was the surviving entity. And it does not appear that they can do that because the merger agreement itself, which we believe is incorporated by reference in their complaint, says in the very first page that Telecor
merged with a subsidiary of AWS, and Telecor was the surviving entity as a wholly owned subsidiary of AWS. And we cited the Jamison case, which is really almost exactly on point on this issue, that that type of merger where you have a surviving entity that becomes a subsidiary, that parent, AWS, does not become a successor in interest to that subsidiary.
But isn't that an issue perhaps for summary judgment rather than on a motion to dismiss?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I don't think so because they have to allege the factual allegations. If they could come forward, Your Honor, and allege
to give the reference that legal conclusion,
we are the successor in interest, they need to start off and make the factual allegations that
give rise to that legal conclusion that they're trying to breach in the cases they cite.
Well, let me see if I have that right. You're saying, number one, the fact is, it is the fact, that the merger was a three-party merger in which Telecorp ended up as a wholly owned subsidiary of AT&T Wireless. Number two, that fact is pled in the complaint or at least inferable. Is that right?
No, I don't.
It isn't right.
No, I think what they allege in their complaint and what they argue in their reply brief is they repeatedly allege that AWS is the successor in interest to Telecorp by virtue of a merger.
And they don't describe the structure of the merger?
Not at all.
So how do we take cognizance of what you're just telling us?
Well, one is that they have the burden, if they want to make a successor in interest argument, they have to allege facts that can then reasonably infer, that you can reasonably infer that. And they haven't alleged, they have the burden to allege those facts, and they haven't done that. And they haven't done that seemingly for good reason. But regardless, they haven't alleged the facts. If they can't allege the facts, there's really no need to.
Is the structure of the merger dispositive of the insurance coverage issue? That is, let's suppose that this was not a three-party merger, but that Telecorp was merged directly into AT&T Wireless. Would that change your position?
It would give them the right to cite the cases that they cited.
Say that they stand in the shoes of
Telecorp as a successor in interest.
So the structure of the merger would be legally significant.
The only case law they've cited to argue that they are a successor in interest is based on the structure of the merger, and that the company claiming the successor in interest status.
I'm asking whether, if the merger was a direct merger rather than a three-party merger, would you have any argument to make?
I would have additional
arguments to make why Clarendon still does not apply. I would say that they would at least have satisfied the successor and interest arguments under those cases. So they have not alleged the facts would give rise to successor and interest status. In the case law that they cite, which refers to in their parent,
the surviving entity in a statutory merger may claim successor and interest status. Jamison case in the Delaware Chancery Court says very clearly, merging in as a subsidiary, the parent does not assume successor and interest status. And that's important because in Jamison, the court says, because the parent is not a successor in interest of rights and liabilities,
Delaware statute requiring indemnification following a merger did not apply.
Mr. Judge, just by way of clarification, all of what we've been talking about since you came to the podium relates to AT&T's claim against Telecorp's insurance tower, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And our, you know, part of our argument is that AWS was never our insured. Telecorp was our insured. We insured these directors and officers. And beyond, so we have this, and we have this express cargo that a third party cannot come in, who's not our insured, and demand coverage and pretend to be insured.
Okay, so the Faraday argument relates to why, at least in the other side's view, they should have a claim against their own insurer, and Clarendon relates to why they should have a claim against your insurer.
Right, and we're saying Clarendon is readily distinguishable because the Teleport policies have the express carve-out that the Clarendon court said would make the intent clear that it would not be covered, and nobody has contended that our carve-out is in any way ambiguous or not clear. Furthermore,
just on the structure of the merger point again, isn't there an express allegation in the complaint that Teleport merged into AWS and AWS succeeded to Teleport's rights under the Teleport D&O policies as well as to Teleport's obligations to indemnify its directors?
There is, right in the first page. And that's the only mention it talks about the merger. Now, as I said, the part about successor and interest is a legal conclusion. The merger into is merely reflecting the point that it merged into as a subsidiary.
But it doesn't say that.
It doesn't say AWS merged with Teleport either, and they can't say that apparently in good faith. We do contend that while this issue was not reached because Clarendon had not been issued,
the merger agreement itself should be incorporated by reference into their complaint because they talk
about the merger.
AWS doesn't cite that merge into sentence. It cites a series of sentences where they say we are legal successor. I have not heard, maybe we'll hear it today, an argument that AWS and Teleport merged and that AWS was the surviving entity. We haven't heard that. It hasn't been alleged. And it is properly cited.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Pass the baton. My name is Jeff Weil. May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of National Union, the excess carrier on both of the policies. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the policy that was issued directly to wireless, but I just want to pick up where Mr. Judge left off and spend a minute or two on the Teleport policy. And the court had some discussion about the structure of the merger. That is not determinative here, Your Honors. What is determinative is whether or not when AT&T Wireless is trying to stand in the shoes of Teleport under the Teleport policy, whether it made that payment as indemnification to the Teleport directors. There was no lawsuit against Teleport, so there's not an entity coverage here. This is an attempt to get coverage for an indemnification to Teleport directors, because those are the only people who are covered under the Teleport policy. If you look at both the settlement itself of the underlying shareholder case, as well as the surrounding judicial proceedings, and particularly I urge the court to look at Appendix B, as in boy, 330, which is an opinion by Vice Chancellor Strein, where he deals with the claim vigorously asserted by AT&T Wireless to be able to maintain or at least preserve their claims against the Teleport directors for contribution. There is this whole fuss that goes on. Actually, it turned it, you know, was a litigation matter about whether AT&T could make a claim against the Teleport directors because the Teleport directors did not contribute a penny to the settlement and didn't even sign the settlement agreement. They're not on the settlement agreement. And so AT&T said, look, we want to be able to go against them. And so not only are they not making an indemnification payment on behalf of the Teleport directors, they are adverse to the Teleport directors. So I think that ends that matter. And I want to move on to the other policy where National Union is also an excess carrier. And just by way of information, because Justice Jacobs asked some questions about it, Lloyd's was the primary on that on that policy, Lloyd/Faraday. There is nothing in the record that they have paid even a penny on that primary policy. So there's been no evidence of any exhaustion. And as Justice Berger noted in the Faraday opinion, actually, when reviewing the structure of these towers, until the primary has exhausted, the excess carrier has no duty or obligation to cover. But let me talk about Exclusion K, which is what Mr. Cronin spent most of his time discussing. Exclusion K says essentially that the carrier is not liable to make any payment in connection with any claim arising out of or in any way involving, and that's a quote, in any way involving, the outside service of the AWS directors on some other board. And let me just spend a minute on, I think, what Justice Jacobs in an earlier argument called the big picture issue. Why have a provision like that? What's the purpose of that? Well, the purpose is actually pretty clear. This is a D&O policy. It's not a duty to defend policy, by the way. It's an indemnity policy. And the carrier, in setting its premium and in doing its underwriting, has to circumscribe the risks that it's insuring. In a D&O policy like this, what's being insured? What's being insured is any wrongdoing that occurs at the company that is being insured. And if the company or the D's and O's get sued for some wrongdoing at that company, there's coverage. What's not being insured, per Exclusion K, for example, is what goes wrong in some other company's boardroom. If something goes wrong in some other company's boardroom, this policy doesn't cover that. Maybe some other policy does, but not this policy. So that's what's behind Exclusion K. It puts a circumference around the risks that the carrier is insuring and allows them to do appropriate underwriting and premium setting. Now let me look more carefully at the language of Exclusion K and distinguish it from Faraday, and then look at the allegations in the complaint and I believe explain to the court how the Exclusion K should be given effect here. The language in this case in Exclusion K, which was negotiated language, Exclusion K, by the way, was revised at least once. There was two very sophisticated parties doing a lot of negotiating and revisions over these policy terms. Exclusion K says that there shall be no liability to make any payment in connection with any claim that arises out of or in any way involves the outside service of AWS officers on somebody else's board. Then you have to go to claim, which takes you to Faraday. The difference, and it's significant between this case and Faraday, is that here, this is not a claim by the D's and O's. This is a claim by AWS for entity coverage. The D&O policy does have some limited coverage, but it's limited for the entity itself, if the entity itself gets sued. That's the basis for the claim here. If you look at page 14 of the opening brief filed by AWS and paragraph 20 of their amended complaint against the carriers, you see that they're making their claim, their standing here is based on a securities action claim. That provides entity coverage. It's number three in the insuring clauses. It's called a securities action claim. Securities action claim is capitalized and it's defined. And that's the definition that you have to look to when you're assessing the claim made by AT&T Wireless here. And the definition of securities action claim is actually very clear. It's not ambiguous at all. And it says a securities action claim shall be any judicial or administrative proceeding that involves claims under the 33 and 34 Act. And then it goes on. But the key language is judicial or administrative proceeding. So you overlay that definition onto Exclusion K, and Exclusion K says in the case of a securities action claim, which is what they're claiming here, that's the only basis to trigger coverage here, then the definition is there shall be no liability to make any payment in connection with any judicial proceeding arising out of or in any way involving the action of the AWS officers serving on some other board, Telecorp in this instance. I don't even think Mr. Cronin is going to contest that if you use that definition of claim, Exclusion K knocks out AWS's claim, because clearly the litigation itself, the judicial proceeding, involved the action of AWS designees on the Telecorp board. The whole litigation was about an allegedly unfair merger. It was required to be a two-thirds vote to approve the merger. The ultimate vote was 8-2. Three of the eight people made it a two-thirds majority. Three of the eight were designees of AWS.
So is the only inference that can be drawn is that the conduct occurred in the Teleport boardroom and nowhere else?
If you read the complaint, yes. And here are the paragraphs to look at in the complaint that I think set out the conduct of the AWS officers and how critical it was to the merger getting completed and all of the alleged wrongdoing surrounding the merger. Paragraph 4 and 17 make general allegations about AWS controlling the Teleport board, including through its three designees. But the interesting ones are paragraph 103, 104, and 118 of the amended complaint filed by the shareholders. Those set out in detail the role played by a director whose last name was Haig, who was an officer of AT&T Wireless. He turns out to be the critical guy in the merger negotiations. He's the go-between. In 103 and 104, the complaint says, Teleport directors went to Haig and said, Mr. Haig, do you think AWS would be interested in a merger with Teleport? 118 says, Haig comes back carrying the word from AWS and says, yes, not only are we interested, but here are the terms. We'll do it on a stock-for-stock basis. He gives the exchange rate, and he says it has to be done in a week. So the key person in putting the deal together is the AWS officer, Haig, who's the go-between. So certainly if you take what I believe is the enforceable definition of securities action claim, the underlying litigation involves the action of AWS officers. All three of them voted for it, and Haig was a key guy.
Okay, well, the other, for whether right or wrong, the other side disputes your characterization. I gather that what we're confronting is not what's being alleged in the coverage complaint, but what is being alleged in the complaint of the underlying lawsuit that was settled.
That's right, Justice Jacobs. I agree with Brother Cronin on that point when he answered your question and said, what do I have to look at to make the determination? He said, you have to look at the underlying complaint and the allegations in it. And I'm saying the same thing, but I'm pointing you to these paragraphs 103, 104, and 118 in particular, which make very clear, in addition to paragraphs 4 and 17, that this merger really got done because of things that were done by AWS officers acting on the Teleport board. I see
Thank
my
you.
Time is up. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me address some of the questions that were raised. First, Justice Berger asked me a question, where in the appendix is there support for the proposition that there were allegations about an AT&T side deal with Bento and Sullivan that did not involve the AWS nominees serving on the Teleport board. These allegations are found in appendix page 218, 221, and 230. They are paragraphs 8, 13, and 37 of the amended complaint filed in the shareholder action. So that responds to the court's question on that point. Second, what we have here is an instance in which, on a motion to dismiss, defendants are asking this court to essentially discredit the allegations that AWS has made that it is successor in interest to Teleport's rights and obligations under the policy. That is not proper on a motion to dismiss. Those allegations should be credited. I just want to read what those allegations are so the court knows what they are and where they're found. Appendix page 40, 42, 43, and 47 contain allegations relating to AWS's successor in interest status. Those allegations say at paragraph 15, quote, AWS has succeeded to Teleport's rights as an insured organization. Paragraph 24 at appendix page 42 through 43, AWS announced a merger proposal. Teleport merged into AWS on February 15, 2002, and Teleport ceased to exist as an independent entity. Appendix page 47, paragraph 45, AWS granted indemnification to the Telecorp directors for defense fees and settlement liability.
Well, I gather there's no dispute as to the actual structure of the merger. That is, it was a three-party merger.
The merger agreement is not before the court.
I understand.
Okay.
But, I mean, what I'm really questioning is whether allegation that you're asking us to credit is one that's doomed to failure once the factual record, if and when the factual record gets developed.
And the answer is I do not know whether that's correct or not. And let me explain, if I may, Your Honor. Telecorp, as I understand it, after the merger occurred on February 15, 2002, did exist as an entity, a wholly owned subsidiary of AT&T. For how long? I don't know. That'll be a subject of discovery. In what capacity? I don't know. I believe its role was simply to run off and pay off some outstanding debts that Telecorp had.
But during the period of time, whatever that may have been, in which Telecorp was a wholly owned subsidiary, that is legally significant, is it not?
That could be legally significant, and it remains to be determined in discovery during what period of time that was and what assets, if any, Telecorp had available to itself to discharge its indemnity obligations. But clearly not on the current state of the record is there support for the proposition that AWS was not the successor in interest. Furthermore, if you look at the policy, the insurance policy in question, I ask you to look at appendix page A76, paragraph 15, and this deals with what happens if a merger occurs. It's the portion of the policy that concerns the coverage available under insurance clause A, B, and C, and it says, if the parent organization merges into or consolidates with another organization, coverage under this coverage section shall continue. In other words, the coverage under insurance clause B was not eradicated and eliminated simply because a merger occurred. What happened is AWS succeeded to Telecorp's rights under coverage B. And I see that
my time
has elapsed.
Thank you
very much, Your Honor.
The court appreciates the arguments and briefing of the parties, and we'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.